people do not know whom to believe when it comes to AI search. And there are a lot of bad actors in the space who promote things that are not true. And there are people who are well-intended, but are wrong.
So can you share a little bit of your main learnings, key highlights from both conferences?
Treat SEO like poker or treat geo like poker, because the following things are true. Nobody knows all the cards. Every player knows some cards. Everybody can make decisions based on the cards that they know. Second point, half the players are bluffing. Not playing is a risk. And then lastly, good players do not need a perfect hand to win.
Before we dive in, you're listening to the Masters of Search podcast with me, your host, Niklas Buschner. Each week, I sit down with some of the smartest people around the world in SEO and AI search to bring you their strategies, mental models, and top pieces of actionable advice. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe and follow it in your favorite podcasting app or YouTube. It helps us get top-notch guests and create the best possible content for you. Let's dive into today's episode. It is time again for a new episode of Monthly Landwehr, my favorite format in this podcast. For everybody that does not know the format, every month, or at least we try every month, but with all the conferences, etc., that is happening, sometimes it's hard. I try to get Malte on the mic to talk with me about everything that has happened in SEO, in AI search, everything that Peak AI is doing, what he's seeing in the market, what he sees is working, is not working, etc., what he's up to. And today we have a full pad because a lot has happened. You have been busy traveling, you have been busy speaking, and you have been busy researching. So a lot to unpack. But first of all, happy to have you, Malte. How are you today?
Happy to be back, and I'm great.
Nice, cool. So let's do a little recap. So you have been present at two, I would say, important marketing conferences. One is a SEO conference, Brighton SEO, and one is the OMR Festival, which is more of a bigger digital marketing conference. How did you like the two?
I enjoyed both. Personally, I learned more at Brighton because the format is more suitable to go to a lot of talks, while OMR was more running around trying to catch people and talking to them. But both were really, really good events.
So you've been in the industry now for at least a decade, even more. What would you say, how have these conferences changed over the years?
Yeah, so I might shock you, but it's been over 2 decades.
2 decades, okay. You seem so young and so fresh and so energetic.
Thank you. I'll turn 40 this year. So whenever somebody says I look young, I take it as a serious compliment. I mean, the OMR, it really started as a very small thing, right? Like as a gathering, and then it turned into this giant event that now had, I don't know, 70,000 visitors or something, 90,000, I have no idea.
I think 70.
Tens of thousands. 70,000, okay. And also Brighton SEO actually started, I think, like 20 years ago as like a gathering. They were meeting in a little room over a pub. And now it's this giant conference with hundreds of talks. So these two events specifically have grown massively, also to a scale that didn't exist 10 years ago. And of course, everything has become more professional, right? Like it used to be a couple of people gather, and sometimes the people who are supposed to give a presentation know about it in advance. And sometimes they even had slides. And now you have a booking management that makes sure every speaker has the right speaker deck, and there's a professional backstage area. And for example, at Brighton SEO, there wasn't even time for any Q&As. It's just 3 or 4 talks, one after another, no break, just to get as much time and as much talks inside people's head as possible. And yeah, so everything has become more professional, more efficient. Lots of change over the last 1 or 2 decades.
And what would you say to people if it's worth it to go to such a conference?
So Brighton SEO is definitely worth it if you want to learn about SEO, especially if you are a beginner or somewhere in the advanced stage, you can learn a lot. If you are on expert level, you are unlikely to learn a lot, unless you go to talks about topics that you are not that deep in. I think if you really want a deep expert knowledge, there are other talks or other conferences, but very, very few. And OMR is really a bit of everything. If you go without a plan, you can easily waste 2 days just aimlessly walking around. But if you want some speakers that you rarely catch, I mean, this year they had Tom Brady, for example. And when do you hear Tom Brady talk about marketing? Probably never. And he actually shared interesting things about leadership. Like, I didn't attend his talk, but there was like an executive lounge where he gave a fireside chat afterwards. And that one I attended. And he had interesting things to say about leadership and how he lived his role as a leader. And I think in previous years, you had people like Kim Kardashian, Ashton Kutcher, et cetera, et cetera. So people you usually will not catch on a conference stage in Europe. And then, of course, there is just this huge exhibition at OMR, similar to DMEXCO or such events. So if you want to talk to a lot of vendors, it's also a good, like just an efficient way to talk to a lot of people quickly.
And did Tom Brady know anything about SEO or AI search?
I don't know. Nobody asked him a question about it, but he knows about leadership and team culture.
Okay, got it. What would you recommend for a more advanced, more senior people, expert level people, which conferences or which events to attend?
There is a technical SEO conference from Audisto in Hamburg once per year. I would say for technical SEO, that is the best event you can go to. And then it really depends. Like, you can go to something like, I mean, of course, I'm very biased towards European events, right? So you can go to something like SEO Campix in Berlin, which is more like meeting a lot of people. And then the learnings are actually between the sessions. I've heard good things about SEOcom in Salzburg. Many, many people say it's like super high quality. I've personally only attended once, so I can't really judge. And then again, if you are based in Europe, generally the SMX events are good to catch a few international speakers that you would otherwise rarely catch in Europe.
Cool. And maybe on that note, a little advertising from ourselves. If you are still free on October 22nd this year in Berlin, we are also hosting a rather small event. So it's not 70,000 people, but rather a little less than 200 people. Which will be the Masters of Search conference, where we partner with PKI and OMR Reviews, where we bring people on stage, where we have not, at least when we record this, revealed everybody, but maybe there will be someone you know well from PKI, we will see. And I think the level of talks will be very hands-on expert knowledge that shares, so a little recommendation from my side. Now let's talk a little bit about what you learned on these conferences, because I think Brighton SEO is obvious that there's a lot of SEO knowledge to unpack. And even with OMR, I was very surprised, or like, let's say positively surprised, that at the stage where you spoke and where also I had the chance to give a keynote talk, there was a lot of AI search actually in the timetable. So can you share a little bit of your like main learnings, key highlights from both conferences?
Yes, yes. So I want to start with two frameworks that I learned. One is the yes-no framework. So basically you go through a set of questions, and only if you answer yes, you're allowed to go to the next question, right? And the first question is there demand? That topic that you want to create your website about, your content, is there actually demand? Only if you say yes, you look at, is the space winnable for you? So does your brand actually have a chance to win? And then you check, do you have content and is it indexable? And if the answer to that is also yes, you should check, do you have some degree of visibility already? And you can apply this, by the way, to SEO or to AI search. It works for both. And if you are visible, the next question is, are you differentiated? If that is also true, you ask yourself, do I have social proof? Next question is, do I have positive brand sentiment? And only if this question, the answer is yes to all of these questions, only then do you start to measure and optimize. And until the answer is not yes to every single of these questions, you just should not think about measurement. You should work on that very thing, because that is the highest leverage thing you can do in that moment. And this resonated very well to me, because when I was an operator in the SEO field, to those who don't know, I used to be the person responsible for SEO at the largest European price comparison website, had a team of 30 to 40 people, or actually a couple of teams. And one thing I always drilled into people is to throw most best practices and most notions of doing something perfect out of the window, and to always think about what has the biggest impact right now. And it is not always to set up the perfect measurement and plan the yearly roadmap. Sometimes it is fix the very obvious thing that is a foundational issue. And that's why I just like this framework a lot. And there was another framework that also resonated with me, and it was treat SEO like poker, or treat geo like poker specifically. Because the following things are true. Nobody knows all the cards. Every player knows some cards. Everybody can make decisions based on the cards that they know. Second point, half the players are bluffing. This is very true in the geo space, where you have a lot of people who sell you magical AI content creation with 100,000 content pieces. Or also Google, for example, who is bluffing a lot when they talk about what works, what doesn't work. Then not playing is a risk. In poker, if you never play, you automatically lose after a while. And the same is true in AI search. If you are too afraid to do anything, you also lose. And then lastly, good players do not need a perfect hand to win. And this resonated with me also very, very well, because, and this comes from my practitioner time as an SEO, you cannot always know everything. But very often, knowing a little bit is enough to start optimizing. And this is, again, for me, all about translating theoretical SEO knowledge and best practices into real business outcomes. And I think this poker analogy also helps people to actually get doing, do some impact, have some impact. And I especially like the notion about not knowing all the cards, because something that I always used to tell my team is, and I didn't invent this, but I forgot who invented it, in SEO and also in AI search, everything falls into three buckets. There are things you can control. You can control if there's no index tags or not, if a URL is blocked in Robots.txt, what content you publish. This is your control. You can influence things. Yeah, for example, your snippet in the Google search result. You can influence that, but you cannot control it. And lastly, there are things that you can only observe, like a Google update happening or ChatGPT switching to a different model. You cannot influence these. And I always instilled it in my teams. When we have a new observation and it's scary and big, let's think about which of these three buckets it falls into and then react appropriately. Because if there was a Google update, there's no need to panic and there's no need to do something today. We can probably analyze it tomorrow or next week. But if there is something wrong with our no index tags, we don't do that. We don't deal with that in a follow-up meeting. We deal with that right now because we can control it. And both frameworks, I think, also fit well in with this worldview that I have on how to make sure your work actually produces business outcomes.
Do you have a cool name for that three-bucket framework?
I don't have a name, but if you have a great name in mind, we can now promote it under that name.
Let's call it the Malte framework. or the three.
I didn't invent it. I forgot who it was. There was another SEO who used to talk about it. I don't want to take credit for it.
Okay. It's always a problem with who invented something and who made something popular. So, can we give credits to the other frameworks, like the yes no framework, for example?
I have to admit, I didn't take notes with names of speakers, so I really forgot for almost everything where I heard it.
Okay, no worries. Maybe we will crowdsource we will use the crowd intelligence to find the person who introduced this great framework, because it makes a lot of sense. Looking at this, was mainly Brighton SEO, right? The takeaways you just shared? Or was it also from OMR?
Most of my takeaways are from Brighton SEO. I attended only like 2 talks at OMR, I have to admit. And one was yours, and I don't want to share your learnings.
No, that's fine.
Do that on your own.
But that honors me. But was it also your feeling that even if you, because obviously you also had to give a keynote, you had to give a masterclass, you probably also had to talk to a couple of partners and clients, etc. But was it also your impression that AI search really was a big thing on OMR this year?
Yes, it was a big thing. And I mean, the OMR team also told me about it beforehand, that it would be a big topic. Because at the end of the day, as a conference, you have to deliver the content that people want. And right now, people want to learn about AI search. And I mean, also OMR uploaded the videos afterwards. And for example, my talk on AI search is now the 4th most watched video from that conference. So there really is interest in the space. And then it just makes sense for conferences to give it a stage.
Yep. Are you sad that you are still behind Pip Klöckner's State of AI? Or I don't know what the title was, but... his famous AI keynote.
I think if I'm losing to Philipp Klöckner, then I'm still doing pretty well in life.
Yeah, I would agree. Did you check the State of the Internet keynote? I mean, the big headline keynote that OMR gives every year, because there was also a huge segment about AI search, AI reviews, etc.
It's on my to-do list to watch it. I've seen outtakes of it that people shared on social media, so I feel like I got the gist of it.
Okay, because I think there are a couple of takes in there where I would actually challenge OMR that this is somehow, some things are right, but some things are maybe a little bit more nuanced. For example, the whole idea of chunking the content. And they gave examples with FAQs, etc. And I mean, it always depends on who is the audience. For people that are not so deep in the space, you obviously have to make it very easy to comprehend. But what's your take on the whole idea of chunking the content?
I 100% believe in it. And I also believe I've seen proof that it works countless of times. There's one important thing. You do not need to artificially chunk your whole content piece. Like, that is probably a bad thing, actually. But what works really, really well is if you have one, I call it a citation chunk. So one chunk, one paragraph of content that you specifically write in a way that it is citable by AI. And actually, earlier today, I saw it work again for similar web who were doing it. It works well. Like, you should think about what is the key statement you want AI to get. And then you write one short paragraph, 2-3 sentences, maybe 50 words. And it must be self-contained, authoritative, and write it in a way that if an LLM would apply the EEAT criteria from Google, it would say, hey, this is good. Specifically name the entities, and it works. Like, if you have a paragraph that says, this is why that tool is good to track LLM visibility in the earlier mentioned countries and is probably like reliable, that LLMs are not going to cite that sentence, right? Because if you take it out of context, it contains almost zero information. But if instead, if you write based on what people write on Reddit and reviews on G2, Peak AI is the best solution to track LLM visibility in China. That is something that LLMs are much more likely to cite. And to think about this at one or two places on the content that you create makes a lot of sense, and it works. Now, obviously, if you write a summary on top or put questions, answers on the bottom, that tends to be the kind of format that fulfills these criteria. But you do not run to write your whole article like this. It would be very painful as a human to read content like that. So don't chunk everything. You also don't have to translate your whole article into a list of bullet points, which is what I've seen some people recommend. But to have this citation chunk in there, it does work. And ideally, it's on the top of the page. That's why for longer pages, like I would say 1,000 words or more, I would actually not do the FAQ on the bottom because it's less likely to be cited if it's that low. I am 100% convinced it works, but people should not bend over backwards to chunk everything, which reads very, very horrible.
Okay, because I was specifically asking about this because I think especially in the last 1 or 2 weeks, there was a lot of discussion again about the guidance of Google and how reliable the guidance of Google is. And to build that bridge, there was a post a couple of months ago about Danny Sullivan. I'm actually not 100% aware who Danny Sullivan is at Google, but it's someone from Google said on one podcast. I don't know if it's the Google search office hours or something podcast, that he does not want content to be chunked and that he does not recommend it, blah, blah, blah. And now we again had this moment of basically two camps. The camp that says, hey, look, Google now launched some guidelines on how to do GEO or not to do generative engine optimization, etc. And then Google talking about your favorite topic, LLMs.txt, and somehow saying it's not important, but then also giving signals that it is important. So let's unpack that a little bit. What happened with this Google guideline thing?
Yeah. So Danny Sullivan used to be search liaison before Google X'd that role. So I would say he's like the main person in that webmaster focused lobby and PR team. So unpacking this. First of all, why does Google give guidance? Google does not give guidance to make you a better SEO. Google gives guidance so that established brands don't mess up the SEO and don't fall victim to snake oil agencies. So that's why they say don't create doorway pages, because you get punished for it, right? Google has no incentive to make you or me rank better in Google. So, and Google, by the way, didn't say don't do chunking. Google said chunking is not needed for AI visibility. Just like Google says link building is not needed for visibility in search results. But we all know that link building can work really, really well, actually. And Google is not the authority for what works on Claude, Perplexity, Grok, or ChatGPT. Google is the authority for what works on Google. So even if we assume that Google had our own best interests at heart, they would still only talk about Google. So very important. And yeah, as I said, it's not a guide to be a better SEO. It's a guide to how to avoid really bad things. And what, of course, people should take away from this is I don't need to chunk everything. But if I want to optimize, if I really want to be the best, right now chunking works. And if something didn't work at all, Google usually doesn't mention it. For example, Google never mentions don't do keyword stuffing in your meta keywords. But doing this is a complete waste of time. Everybody who does it just wastes their time. So why does Google not advise people to not doing it? Because they don't look at meta keywords at all anymore. So it doesn't work anymore. It's not relevant anymore. So they don't need to warn people to do it. I mean, when did Google speak the most that buying links is bad? They did that at the time when buying links worked really, really, really well. When did Google introduce the site reputation abuse rule? When it worked really well and when they had no way to algorithmically detect it. So I think the interpretation of this chunking advice is kind of obvious. I'm always shocked that so many people use it as like, this is now the holy Bible of how to do SEO. Because if you follow everything that Google says, you avoid doing really bad things, but you also avoid doing all the good things that actually give you the big success. And then the LLMs.txt, there are two perspectives, right? There is the I want visibility perspective, and there Google is right. LLMs.txt is a waste of time. It's just a normal text document. But for agent readiness, so how do I explain to an agent how to use my website? How do I make it possible for agents to discover my MCP server, my AI, my API? How do I explain to agents how to obtain an API key? For all of these things, and LLMs.txt is a really good tool. And that's why it's included in the Google Lighthouse audit. And here SEOs need to remember, Lighthouse is not primarily an SEO tool. It's for accessibility and usability, and agent accessibility will be part of this in the future.
And what do you think why so many people were so, I don't know, excited, or at least it made the impression to me that they're excited about this guide from Google, optimizing, quoting here the title, optimizing your website for generative AI features on Google search?
Yeah, I mean, people do not know whom to believe when it comes to AI search. And there are a lot of bad actors in the space who promote things that are not true. And there are people who are well-intended but are wrong. And if you consume content from a few months ago, you might read something that was correct at that time but is no longer correct. And since people have way too high trust into Google, they think, now Google talked about it. Okay, now we have a real source. And of course, Google disagreed with some things that people who are deeply into AI search talk about. And then SEOs who are not into that topic, I think they just like it. Like, yeah, you see, you were wrong. I guess that's why people were so excited about it.
So it's still just the polarized camps, basically, the ones that are skeptical of AI search in the first place, seeing their narrative confirmed and then saying, ha, told you. And then on the other hand, basically people that believe in AI search to be a thing, to put it very broadly, saying, hey, you know, Google just always had the advice, create great content, create great content. And SEO was never just create great content, but far more than that. So this is basically why we see that. But what would you recommend people to do about ambiguous signals? Because in this very guide from Google, they mention LLMs.txt and they say you don't need to create new machine readable files, AI text files, markup or markdown, etc. But then on the other hand, we have, as you already mentioned, Lighthouse, where they explicitly mention LLMs.txt and where it's actually also checked. So this is something where I sense that some people are just confused, and obviously there are things behind it and details behind it, but it's just, hey, on the one hand, you say it's not important, and then seemingly it is important, so what's true?
I mean, both is true, right? It is not needed for visibility in search. It is recommended to make your website usable for agents. These are just two different concepts, and something can be right in one worldview and not correct in another worldview, so... And actually, this is how many people have described LLMs.txt for years, right? Like, I wrote a blog article about this shortly after I joined PKI because I was so annoyed by it. And this is exactly what I said back then. Like, it's not about discoverability. It's about understanding when agentic usage is intended. And people just need to understand that these are two separate things.
Now let's talk about something that you just published recently, because as we already said, there are like some people that just pump out advice, and it's sometimes called snake oil, and they do not ground it in actual research. But the team at PKI is always busy in basically putting your papers where your mouth is. I don't know how to make a good saying out of this, but checking what works by compiling first party data. And you released something where you actually also have to explain to me what happened there with this whole research publication, etc., because it felt like, okay, is PKI now going into academics or something? But you published this paper, which is called The Listicle Rank Effect, What 200,000 AI Responses Across 8 AI Engines Reveal About Brand Visibility. So the hook is definitely catchy with a lot of numbers. So please tell me what this is about.
Yeah, we wanted to measure what is the impact of being mentioned in a listicle. And the first thing we did is we divided this into three data sets: third-party listicles, your own self-referential listicles you put on your own website, and competitor listicles. And then we try to build an understanding and try to model it out and put in a lot of effort to exclude the randomness. So not just do some correlation study where it always turns out, oh, popular brands are mentioned on top of listicles, but trying to correct for all of that. And if you want to know the details, please read the paper. But in essence, what we could take out as a learning is that for third-party listicles across very different industries, we could form a very good understanding of what the impact is. This was not true for your own listicles, and this was not true for competitor listicles. That doesn't mean that those don't work. It just means that the impact is not that well understood, observable, describable, which can have many reasons. We can talk about that that later. And the main learning we had is, and let's simplify this, you have a listicle that is regularly cited in LLMs. You have two brands. One brand is number one in that listicle. The other brand is anywhere in the top 10. The brand that is listed number one will have a 13 to 17 percentage point visibility increase, meaning the chance to be mentioned. So if their chance to be mentioned was 20% with this listicle, it will be 33 to 37%. Yeah, it's a really huge increase. And they will also be on average ranked higher position-wise. So if they used to be on average in the LLM answer on position 5, with that listicle number one placement, they will go to position 4 or 3. And the amount of times that they are mentioned within the answer will also increase by 0.5 to 1 times. Of course, these are averages, right? If you're already at 100% visibility, that listicle will obviously not increase your visibility, etc., etc. And this is, of course, across multiple different answer engines, and it can be bigger impact in ChatGPT, lower impact in Grok, etc., etc. But these are the averages that we observed. Now, for the brand that is only mentioned in the top 10, we still observed over millions of observation a 6 to 16 percentage point visibility increase, slightly higher rank in the answer, but not even one position gain. So what we can know for sure is any mention in the top 10 is good. So if you ever ask yourself, should I be not mentioned in the listicle at all, or should I be on position 9? Position 9 is better than not being mentioned at all. And if you ask yourself, do I really want to be number one, or is it okay to be anywhere? If you just want to optimize your visibility, actually being placed anywhere in the top 10 is just fine. If you really want to be mentioned on top in the LLM answers, you need the number one spot in the big, most important third-party listicles. That is essentially what our research found out. And I gave a pretty big range, like 6 to 17 percentage point. That's huge, right? And that is because we found two criteria by which markets diverge. The one is mature versus new markets. A mature market means the LLM has probably in the model knowledge already information about the brands, already a perception on how important which brand is, like cars or airlines or which cities to visit or anything around that. And then the grounding process seems to be more about reassuring themselves of their model knowledge. But there's very little information gain coming from the grounding, right? There are very few new car companies, airlines, cities to visit. But in a very new market, there might be very low or outdated or even zero knowledge in the model itself. And then basically the grounding process is the main data source, sometimes the only data source, and then it has a huge impact. And so that's one dimension on which markets can diverge. And the other dimension is how common are listicles? Because there are markets where listicle is a very common content format, and then in some, these listicles tend to have a big impact, but each listicle on its own might have smaller impact. And there are cases where very few listicles exist. And then there might be like one major listicle from a super authoritative domain that gets all the power. So these are the biggest differences. And yeah, I think another thing that could be interesting, there are LLMs that usually cite very few URLs. And there, of course, one listicle can have big impact. And there are also LLMs or LLM-based answer engines that cite a lot of pages, like AI mode, AI overviews, and usually have a lot of sources. There, the impact of each single listicle tends to be smaller. And yeah, we have all the numbers in the paper, but I think going through them here is just boring. But yeah, this is the rough summary of what our research showed.
So the key takeaway is that I should closely monitor citations of third-party listicles for the prompts I track, and then see how I can get into these listicles and ideally as far to the top as possible.
Ideally position one. So
yeah, okay,
we had industries where we could observe that like position two is strictly better than position three, etc., etc. But if we are being very scientific here, I have to say we also had cases where there was no huge difference between position 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In those cases, the only recommendation would be somewhere in the top 10, ideally be number one. Logically, it would make sense that position 3 is better than position 4, etc., etc. But actually, our data did not show that for every LLM and every industry we looked at. So we can still give this as a recommendation because it makes sense, but it's not actually something we can prove with data.
And did you check in any way whether these listicles are like organic listicles, review sites, etc.? And even on review sites, we know that there are ways to sponsor certain positions, to bind to certain positions. So did you in any way differentiate, or could you check between organic, natural mentions and listicles and those that are paid or sponsored?
We did not. But based on my industry knowledge, the vast majority of listicles have a paid aspect nowadays. There's very few motivation for third-party websites to create listicles outside of earning affiliate commissions or being paid to place someone on top. So if I see a listicle, I just assume that money was involved nowadays.
And for these observations, and then obviously, as marketers always do, they try to exploit the hell out of it. Do you think that the grounding process, obviously this is speculative now, but the grounding process and how LLMs compile their citations and then form the answer, do you think that the strong influence of listicles will be lower over time because it's just so easily exploitable by buying myself into the top positions? I mean, I was thinking about Google back then and the top 10 Google results. And then some people were saying, okay, yeah, you can just buy your way to the top with Google ads, but you still had a lot of organic rankings. But if you think about listicle, where every spot is paid for, then there's not really an organic play there anymore.
Yeah, I do believe that the impact of these listicles will go down. I believe at some point it will make sense for all the LLM labs to build pipelines where they just consume Reddit content, Google Maps reviews, G2 reviews, etc. I mean, many of these are paid for also, but basically, based on what they find on the internet, create their own listicles because it is so polluted. The listicle world is so polluted now by artificially influenced rankings. And I think there is still a year or two left where listicles will work very, very well. But obviously, at some point, if it's so manipulated, LLMs will need to interfere.
And did you also think about doing a similar analysis or study around self-promotional listicles and their impact? Because there's also a big discussion right now. Obviously, the tactic is very controversial. Yet, as you also said in your OMR keynote, it maybe unfortunately still works. So it's a trade-off between I don't want to overdo because I don't want to harm my site long term. But if I don't do it now, then maybe a competitor with a higher risk appetite basically gets more growth than I will get. So did you also think about that, doing it for self-promotional listicles?
I mean, we didn't just think about it. We tried it, but we couldn't find this clear takeaways that we had for the third-party listicles, which suggests that first-party listicles or own listicles, however you want to call it, have some different characteristics by which they are interpreted. In some data sets for some LLMs, there was a suggestion when you look at the data that maybe the top-ranked brand in a self-promotional listicle doesn't get the same boost that the other brands in that listicle are getting, but we could neither prove nor properly falsify this. And if all of your data is inconclusive or statistically not significant, then it makes little sense to publish it. So we did, but we couldn't find anything interesting that we thought is worth publishing.
Okay, now I can imagine a couple of, I would say, also marketers with a higher risk appetite thinking about, wait a second, but I could now register third-party domains, so to say, and publish listicles on there, and the domain is not my brand name, so PKI would maybe, hypothetically, buy a domain that is called geo-tools.com or .ai or .io, and then you publish a couple of listicles on there, maybe also some adjacent content that somehow creates the feeling of this being an industry blog, and then you create these listicles and you put yourself on top, and then it's suddenly not a self-promotional listicle anymore, at least maybe the LLMs don't recognize it, and then this is a great strategy, right? What would you say to those?
I mean, people are doing it. And it works. Right now, it works. There is also a business model already where people buy keyword domains like, I don't know, SEO conferences, SEOconferencereviews.com. That's not an example. It doesn't exist. And then they list SEO conferences. So then they say, hey, you want to be ranked number one? Pay me money. And by the way, we were cited 16,000 times last month by ChatGPT. So there's really an industry being created around this right now. Obviously, it is problematic, but I'm just right now looking at a project I created specifically for this. And I see the domain that I'm monitoring is on position 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, on position 9. For is the 9 most cited domain in their space. Of course, like Reddit and YouTube are ahead, but this is a domain. It is cited in 15% of the prompts that I'm monitoring, and it has outstanding impact on which brands are recommended. And maybe that can be a follow-up study to see when the content of that domain changes because someone pays money to be the top domain at the top brand, how their brand visibility for this set of prompts changes. So yeah, people are doing this.
Very interesting. I want to have a final take of you on this because I also asked it Lily Ray, because I think it's not so easy to find the right balance between acknowledging and observing what's working right now that might be a little, let's say, sketchy or that has some nuance to it. Like maybe this is quite a strong example with buying the domain and then masquerading as a third-party domain, and actually it's just an advertorial portal, so to say. But then also thinking about the long-term impact. So will this work long-term? Does it harm my brand? Does it harm my website? But then also, I don't want to lose against the players with a higher risk appetite that just do all these things now, and somehow they get the bigger share of the market. So what would you advise to people on, or do you have mental models also from your vast experience on how to find the right balance between what's working right now that might not feel right long term and acknowledging that if you do not do it now, others will win, but then clapping yourself on the shoulder, yeah, but we're doing the right thing also ethically, etc. So this is something that I'm pondering a lot about in the last month with all this stuff that is working, but then also not working. Yeah, long question.
Yeah, no, this comes up quite regularly because I often meet with some of our larger clients and then they are like, okay, what is really working? And then I talk about things like this, for example, and then they're like, okay, cool, but like, we can't do that. I think I would always look at what is in my toolbox, what am I comfortable to do? And if I'm a very large brand and I cannot publish listicles because somebody will sue me, then I should not publish listicles. And then do I pay an agency to create a website in their name and publish a listicle there to promote me? And do I think I can get away with that? And is it actually legal? These are all questions people have to answer for themselves. And I don't want to answer that for anybody. I would just give a warning that sometimes your brand is one of your most precious things. And you should not ruin it. And you should also not ruin the reputation of your domain within Google if you are in this for the long run. If you have a multi-brand strategy, you could consider maybe going all in on AI visibility with one of these brands and then risking that it's gone at some point. And you can be smart and you can think about how can I leverage this. For example, reviews. You could create a page, radiant.com/reviews, and you just list reviews and awards you have won. And you cite from them, and you have these citable chunks of like, dududum said Radiant is the best SEO agency for startups and scale-ups in Europe. Or Radiant is the best AI search visibility agency in Berlin, or whatever. Like, if you find someone who said that about you, you could just quote them. You provide the source. That's completely legal. Nobody can sue you for it. It's smelled maybe tiny bit cringe, but actually not that much. Like, it's very acceptable. Or you could say, you could make a page, Reddit. And you could just say things that people said about Radiant on Reddit. Like, Niklas is the best podcast host. If somebody said that, you say, Trash Hamster 98 on Reddit said Niklas is the best podcast host, link to the source, right? And then when LLMs have fan out queries like SEO agency Reddit to look for, usually to look for Reddit as a source, but then because of how fan out queries and retrieval systems like Google work, they would also maybe find this page and use it for grounding. So there are clever things you can do. And you just need to be a little bit creative and think about, like, you basically need to look at what works and you need to deconstruct it and then think about why does this work. And usually it's a combination of, it is the exact content that would rank for the fanout queries, and it is content that is digestible for LLMs, and it is content that is loaded with trust signals that an LLM, when it's reasoning about should I use this or not, makes it say, yeah, I should probably use this. So just deconstruct these methods, then think about it creatively. And I have seen companies come up with interesting things to do this, also in highly regulated industries, also in industries where the government is looking at you, also for brands that everybody on the planet knows. I can't talk about examples, of course, because this was like, I was not the genius who invented these ideas. I was just in the room when people had good ideas about this. So there are ways, and the key mechanic is deconstruct the mechanism that works, try to bring it back to the ingredients that work, and then just think about it from first principles. How can I apply this to some degree to my website, even if I'm not able to create a listicle for the, I don't know, best airline to fly with because my brand is too well known.
Okay, this is a very helpful mental model, actually, around it. Thanks so much for sharing this. Last question I have is, besides what we talked about, what was an observation over the last 3 to 4 weeks that you found most surprising or maybe that excited you or just something that stuck with you from our space, no matter where it came from?
I have a couple of small things and then one there. I need to say a few sentences. I saw a study finally that proved that URLs with good core web vitals have a higher likelihood to be cited by LLMs. There was already data on this from like 2-3 years ago when Google had this SGE beta. But since then, I haven't actually seen anyone repeat it. Again, I forgot who did it, but we can maybe put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
I also saw that the kinds of sources that AI Mode and AI Overviews are using are super, super different. I knew this already, but it's like interesting to see that also other people are observing this, because you would think, hey, it's all based on Gemini, so it should be very similar, but it's so, so, so different. And I think it's caused by two facts. With AI Overviews, you have always the regular links below it as like a fallback. So it needs to provide something else than these links, while AI Mode is more like, this is the full service answer. And also the overview needs to be quicker, so you have less time to look at sources, less time to apply typical like spam filtering, etc. So these are things that really stuck with me. Then also at Brighton SEO, somebody showed a case study from Pretty Little Things, an online shop, where they changed some of their categories from something like jeans or dresses to intent-driven categories like airport outfits, and it worked so well, they actually sold out every single item in these categories. And some people might know that I've worked in e-commerce for a while, and without revealing any internal things from previous employers, I would just say I'm not surprised that this is working, and I'm happy that somebody talked about this publicly. I can very much encourage you to try to do that. And the final thing I want to mention is also from Brighton SEO. Somebody asked the audience for a thought experiment. If your next 1 million customers never visit your website, what does it mean for your branding, for your marketing, and for your content production? And if you do that, you probably end up with a strategy that is also really good for AI visibility.
Awesome. Malte, thanks so much. There was so much in this. I think a lot for people to unpack. It's always great to talk to you. And we will make a great effort to see that we can find all the credits to the people you mentioned and the ideas and the frameworks. I'll do my best with the help of my very, very good and disciplined friend, Claude. And always a pleasure to talk to you. Already looking forward to the next one, and wishing you and the team at PKA all the best.
Likewise, and thank you.
Thank you so much.